Welcome to the Free Improv Pod. This, the first in an occasional series of podcasts focusing on free improvisation and other interesting musics and musicians. I am Peter Urpeth, a writer and occasional improvising musician living and working in the Outer Hebrides, Scotland. I've written about free improv and jazz for more than 30 years, and when it comes to music, this music is my real passion. This series started with the realisation that some of the interviews and sound content I gather in my work as a writer might also work well as an audio podcast. This, the first in the series, was recorded with enough care to make it useful for my work in print and with no intention of being a podcast, so forgive any bumps or clicks in this recording. Future episodes will be recorded with podcasting very much in mind. So enough of an intro. This podcast features an interview with guitarist, teacher and organiser John Russell, recorded at his home in North London in January 2015. The music you will hear dotted about this podcast is taken from Weak Apostle, the first track on John Russell's 2009 recorded solo guitar CD Hyste, H-Y-S-T-E that is, released on the PSI label, number PSI 10.06. Full details of that CD and many others available at mnmdisc.com/PSI. Since the early 1970s, John has been very prominent as a player, a mainstay of the UK free improvisation scene, and a highly regarded musician across Europe and in other scenes and improv traditions such as that of Japan. If listening were given the status it deserves as the key instrument in any free improvisation process, John would be recognised as a world virtuoso. He is a musician of incredible sensitivity, spontaneous creativity, openness and generosity, and I think many players of a younger generation have found, when working with John, a new place of growth and confidence in their own music. John, of course, performs regularly with other leading musicians from across Europe, including very long-standing fixtures with saxophonist Evan Parker, and his adaptability and flexibility as a player can be witnessed in his rewarding and often intriguing duets with jazz trumpeter Henry Lowther, to name but two of many enduring musical relationships in John's free improvisation world. John is a key organiser of gigs and festivals, organising Kwakwa, a collective of free improvisation musicians for occasional gigs and festivals that has been running since 1981, and Mopamoso, which is currently organised on a regular basis at the Vortex, Dalston in East London, being the longest running regular free improv gig in the UK, starting in 1991. This work alone, along with those who assist John, has made a huge contribution to the music in the UK. For more info about John and his activities, please see his website, john-russell.co.uk. If you enjoy this podcast and want more info, please visit my blog site, peterurpeth.wordpress.com. That's Peter, U-R-P-E-T-H. And links related to this podcast will also be there if you don't catch them just now. This recording then picks up where John is talking about how he first encountered the music of saxophonist Evan Parker. I hope you enjoy it, and if so, please subscribe to this podcast series. Thank you.
Richard Williams used to write in Melody Maker about free improvised music and review records by Evan, Derek Bailey, John Stevens, the scene at the time. And I was living in a small village in Kent and used to get the Melody Maker delivered weekly from the neighbouring village where there was a shop.
What kind of year is this?
Crikey, when would that be? 70, 71? Or maybe earlier, 69, 70, something like that. I'm not sure exactly. 70, 71, I think, actually, more. And the music intrigued me. And at that time, local record shops, if you gave them the title of the record and who was on it, would look in a big book.
Yeah,
and they'd find it. It might take two months, but you'd get it. And the local town, Ashford in Kent, had three record shops, one of which was more obliging than the other two, so I used to go to that one. And a friend of mine, Jeff, who was 18 months younger than me in the same village, had a bit more disposable income, So okay. I'd sort of say to him, this is interesting, and he'd get the records because he was a real record nut, you know. So I heard Tony Oxley's four compositions for Sextet, Olive, was it, or Carrie Obin, a few things time, you know, when they came out. And as I say, I found it very intriguing.
Yeah. The
music was very intriguing. But then my first improvised music gig was after I'd moved from Kent. I went to King's Langley between Watford and Hemel Hempstead and worked on a farm.
Uh-huh.
And I went there ostensibly to play with some musicians up there. And I used to come into London with them, and one of the people there said he knew Janice Christensen, who was Derek Bailey's partner at the time.
Okay. Yeah.
And would I like a lift to go and see the London Jazz Composers Orchestra at Ronnie Scott's? It was a musicians' co-op thing. So I, I said yes, please, and off we went. And at the gig, there was a tenor saxophone solo from Evan, and it was just engaging.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the music was intriguing. It was kind of like, what's this stuff? And that's intriguing stuff. And I sort of liked it. And I was kind of interested in, you know, I was sort of reading stuff on aleatoric music and, you know, all sorts of stuff you do as a teenager, checking out all these different things. But to hear that tenor solo, and I quote it a lot, it really grabbed you. You know, it was really, it was such a physical experience as well as an emotional experience as well as an intellectual thing. And so that was great. At the same gig, there was a guy called Robin Musgrove who was having drum lessons from John Stevens. And Robin had been at the first year at my grammar school, and then his parents had moved away. And I recognised him and said, aren't you Musgrove? And he said, yes.
Yeah.
And Robin then started coming up to King's Langley and also introduced me to Dave Solomon, who I played in a duo with at the Little Theatre Club, my first ever improvised music gig when I was 17. And I played an orange 100-watt stack and an electric guitar going up five bloody flights of stairs. Dear, oh dear. And it was a racket. I was just letting my fingers fall on the strings.
Yeah.
Also at that time, Chris, who drove me there and knew Janice, introduced me to Janice and in turn Derek Bailey. And I said to Derek, and I'd just seen Henry Cow play in a church hall in Watford.
Okay.
And I said to Derek, did you teach Fred Frith? And he said, no. And I said, do you give lessons? And he said, yes. But he didn't teach the way he played. And I said, well, I'm not necessarily interested in learning that.
Yeah.
I want to learn as much as possible about the guitar. And he was ideal. I went to him for a year because he used to be in the Russ Conway Trio, you know, the Dave Lee group on, I'm sorry, I'll read that again, Pit Orchestra, Opportunity Knocks, Saturday Night Out with the Stars, all of those, Bachelors, you know, all of these things. So I got a broader view of the guitar from playing sort of stuff influenced by Goblin Pig, John Mayall, you know, that whole British blues boom into the prog rock scene stuff, you know. And that foundation was the really great thing from Derek. So from this one gig, everything came from this gig. And that was the first time I saw Evan.
Was it Ronnie Scott's?
Was it Ronnie Scott's? London Jazz Composers Orchestra gig put on by the Musicians Co-op. Quite soon after that, I played the Little Theatre Club. I met Evan, of course. I remember one particular gig he did in the Little Theatre Club with Paul Litton. Because being a theatre club, it would sometimes have the sets there.
Yeah,
and there was this set of a sort of West Indian boarding house, and it was like the stoop in bamboo, and Paul and Evan were somehow playing on that, and I'm convinced they were wearing Hawaiian shirts for the gig, but I'm not 100% sure, you know, how that
history or something.
Somebody would have to sort of go on my memory about that, but that was great, you know. And you'd always end up with about two or three people in the audience mostly, but sometimes it'd be more than that, you know. And So everybody was very approachable at that time on the scene, which was wonderful, you know.
And what was your sort of, I mean, just going back a little further, what was your kind of interest? I mean, did you come from a sort of a jazz liking background?
No, not at all. I was brought up in a village called Ruckinge on the edge of Bromley Marsh by my paternal grandparents, and I never knew my mother. I was left in their care from the age of 15 months, and my father used to visit once a year, and, you know, Christmas sort of thing. We didn't even have a flush lavatory until after my grandfather died, and then my father paid for a bathroom extension because it was a tin bath and an earth closet, you know, that's what we had then. And my great-grandmother was alive until a month before my grandfather died. She was about 96. So it was a very rural, very Victorian upbringing almost. So when I went to the grammar school, it was like a different world, you know. And I kind of heard about this music stuff. And, you know, I'd seen the music press and the disc and music echo, and I was getting kind of aware of this stuff. I think I might have seen A Hard Day's Night in the local cinema. My uncle took my cousin and me to see it, I think. And so there was a kid in my class who had a Martin Coletti guitar called Jeff Manuel, and he played with a guy in the fourth year in lunch breaks and stuff, playing House of the Rising Sun, which was the number one hit of the time, sort of thing. And I badgered my grandparents. I said, I want a guitar. So on the monthly trip into town, my grandfather didn't get his shoes that month, and I got a guitar, basically. And a book called A Tune A Day. I didn't get the Burt Whedon one. Mm. And because I was suspicious, the Burt Whedon one said play in a day, and I thought, well, it must take longer than that. So I'll do A Tune A Day. And took it home and sat down with it for 5 hours and learned Skip My Lou on the top two strings, which I still use as a teaching thing today if I get a beginner coming. And then I was kind of hanging out with the older kids, you know, because I got a guitar. It was this kind of social, it was a way of fitting in from somebody from a completely outside business. So I was learning from the older kids at school. There was a guy called Bill Redding who was in a group called, can't remember, had one top 40 single and stuff later on. But Bill was a very competent, he had this group called Axis, which was a seven-piece group, I think was seven pieces, two guitars, keyboards, two saxophones, maybe doubling trumpets somewhere, bass, drums. Mm. And they do kind of soul numbers. He was a big Alvin Lee fan 10 years after, so I learned some 10 years after licks from him, and also you know, copied from the record and stuff, and stuff like, and also Mick Abraham's Blobbing Pig, the John Mayall records, you know, so you just try and copy the licks as best as possible. But I wasn't using my fourth finger or anything like that, so, and I was kind of interested. I immediately fell for Zappa, you know, as a 15 year old, as Zappa said, the majority of listeners to The Mothers of Invention are 14 year old kids from a broken home.
Yeah,
and it was that kind of thing. I mean, there's this rebellious, funny-looking guy, you know, doing all this stuff, and also with the kind of air of pretension about saying names like Stravinsky or Eric Dolphy on his sleeve notes and stuff like that, you know. But the other thing about that was that I wasn't getting any formal lessons, so it was like everywhere was grist to the mill. So I'd be listening to John Peel's show, and at that time, in my bedroom under the sheet, all of that stuff. And at that time, you get a Joni Mitchell record followed by a Led Zeppelin record followed by Ravi Shankar followed by John Coltrane or whatever. You know, it was completely across the board. It wasn't bashed into this genre thing. And I think there was a particular time, maybe 68, where the music kind of took over and the record companies lost it. You know, they put a lot of money into bands that they lost and very small amounts of money into bands that made it somehow. Yeah. And they didn't know what was going on. And then you have programmes. There was was it Jazz 65? I can't remember. But I remember seeing the Stars of Faith gospel group and Cecil Taylor, you know, in the same series. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's just great. Instead of all this sort of genre stuff. So, and then the local library, Pearl on Serialism and Atonality. Not much of it sunk in, but some of it did, you know. Yeah. And I had a little rock group in the village, and I'd sort of taught a guy how to play bass guitar, and my friend Jeff was sort of hitting saucepans and stuff, and there was a guy called Albert on drums, me on guitar, and I'd write these kind of pieces that would be like little bits of Serial music interspersed with funny time signatures. And all of that, and then I'd do a bit where I'd try a guitar solo where I just let my fingers fall on the strings. And really, that was the kind of stuff that I started in the free improvisation stuff, because you need material, was kind of gestural stuff. Yeah, you know, there's a particular Sonny Sharrock track on Monkey Pocky Boo. I can't remember which one it is, but it's like crash, crash, bash, wallop. You know, it's fantastic. It's so liberating, that thing, to make that gesture. So, and I still kind of use that gestural thing a bit when I give workshops. Now I kind of start by saying, is an air a great thing? You know, because we breathe, it's all around us, we breathe it keeps us alive, it's fantastic, but it's also elastic. You know, you hit it and it bounces back and it makes these air waves which we hear in the ear. And it's just this quality of air is wonderful. So let's move some air. So it kind of tricks them into sort of making some noise without having to think too much about what sort of noise should I make. You know, because that comes later. It's got to be from the activity, from that activity based thing.
It's I mean, almost like a bigger leap in terms of approaches or ethos to be somewhere following someone like Frank Zappa, who's very controlling and very detailed, to then go into an environment of something like Little Theatre Club, where you've got the idea of a kind of a very shared collective approach, you know.
Yeah, although I was never any good, really, at the Zappa stuff. You know, I mean, I wasn't particularly good guitarist in those days, and I could hide. I mean, my first thing in improvising was hiding. I do a lot of hiding. I mean, when I was playing with Dave, that was different. I'd make this racket, you know. But when you're playing in John's group, you spend a lot of time sort of hoping you're fitting in, you know. But having said that, there was one point during one of his workshop pieces, Search and Reflect, which I think is a fantastic piece, actually. Where just being in the present, I got this real sense of high, you know, I was really high from this music. Years later, I asked the guy who was emeritus professor of psychology at Castle, he was head of department, I think, if psychologists recognise transcendental feelings. And he said, yes, we do, but the only thing we know about them is as soon as somebody says, I'm having a transcendental feeling, it goes. And that's a bit like the music, you know, as soon as you try and grab it, it's gone, it just goes, you know, you can't do that. And I had that experience in this piece from John, and it was quite amazing. There was a sort of lot of mystical stuff around it, of course, in the way he dealt with, you know, it's all beautiful, oh, beautiful, beautiful, it's all beautiful, and, you know, all of that, hello trees, hello flowers, yes, mold sort of thing, or Fotheringay Thomas, isn't it? In the book, but it was genuine, you know. John was a driven man, actually, and he was a great proselytizer and opened those doors. But there was a discipline to it, you know. He could sort of, if you weren't knuckling down to that system, you'd get told off.
Yeah, kinds of rules of engagement, you know, which were set up to generate things, I think, you know. Which he used to talk about. I mean, I remember one, the kind of thing about, you know, if you stop playing if you can't hear everyone else, and that kind of...
That's the search and reflect thing.
Kinds of little rules and regulations, enabling things.
Well, again, that's one I use in my workshops, is search and reflect. I mean, I use these things and sort of say, and this is an approach by John Stevens, and, you know, I don't just nick it, you know, because it's a kind of historical side to this as well for me, that it's important people... get a little bit of an idea of that, you know. But I once got told off for going for a piss. I was bursting and the music was going on. I sort of went, I left, you know, in the Little Theatre Club, no audience.
yeah.
you know, large group. And I sort of nipped to the loo and had a pee and yeah. came back, and he stopped the group and said, "This shows disrespect." And I said to him, "John, do you want to do me to just sit here and pee myself?"
yeah.
You know, and I'm not going to sort of stop the music. I yeah. thought that makes more respect doing yeah. that, you know.
What did
and
you,
he sort of said, "Oh, all right then."
What did you make? I mean, because the little theatre club is obviously it's a name that occurs all the time in
yes.
inquiries about the history of this music and so this development and so on. You know, what also occurs all the time are these questions about the dynamic there, about, you know, really what was the mood between people? What was the, you know.
I think there was developing factionalisations, actually, or factionalisms or something. You know, there was a few people. John was very all-embracing. Anybody can do this music. It's all in there. But then there were people who'd sort of say, "Well, it's a bit naff, really." And there was a kind of point for me, you know, when, because he used to do two groups and then a jam at the end. It sort yeah. of fell into this routine quite a few times. And the trouble is, you'd have sort of, it seemed like, maybe it wasn't true, but it seemed like you'd have 13 alto saxophones players of varying degrees of ability, all be trying to find a corner to blow in so that they could hear themselves. And the music would end up as a drone, you know, yeah. when they're trying to find the common level. And John would say, "If we're all climbing a mountain, and somebody falls back, we're not interested in getting to the top of the mountain. We want to see why that person's fallen back," which is kind of okay as a sort of collective social thing. But actually, if it ends up as a lowest common denominator drone, it's bloody boring for yeah. me. Or it was as a young man. It was yeah. completely, yeah. I wanted to find out other stuff and do yeah. other stuff. I was maybe a bit impatient, but, you know, that's how I felt. So there was a kind of thing where people sort of split away a little bit, and yeah. both Dave Solomon and myself liked the musicians co-op very much. This was after John had left and Oxley wasn't in it
mm-hmm.
and stuff, and we were really, I guess, our real sort of preferences were Derek Bailey, Evan Parker and Paul Rutherford.
Yeah,
that's not to denigrate Lou Gehr, Eddie Prevost and Howard Riley, who yeah. I think were the other members. I think that's it. Oh, Lytton
yeah.
also. But we wanted it a bit more spiky, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
Somehow. So oh. we go to the Musicians Co-op concerts, and then Bailey decided he'd had enough of the Musicians Co-op. He was going to swim off in his own direction, which he did a few times in his varied career.
Yeah.
But before he did that, he said that the Musicians Co-op should have some new blood and they should invite me and Dave Solomon to become members.
Okay.
So we were invited to be members, and we kind of potted around there and did some gigs. And then Dave and I suggested Steve Beresford should join as well. So Steve came on board, and we did, I think it was a couple of series maybe at the Unity Theatre.
Yeah.
When it was near Mornington Crescent. And then that burnt down, and then there wasn't a grant. There was a small grant, I think, from the, whatever it was called at the time, the Greater London Arts or
yeah.
something like that. And there was no grant. So it fell into abeyance for about 2 or 3 months. And this hiatus, somebody suggested we should have a London Musicians Collective, and it grew from that. There's a kind of feeling that some people say, oh, the Musicians Co-op grew into the London Musicians Collective. And it's wrong, it didn't. The Musicians Co-op finished.
And then,
So I think that's quite an important point to make.
Yeah.
And also during this time, you see, because the Little Theatre Club had closed, and I started organising gigs. My first gig was, while the Musicians Co-op was going, near Kentish Town, Prince of Wales, whatever it's called. And it was a squatted pub. And in order to get to the gig, you had to go through a hole in the ground, you know, where they put the barrels.
The cellar doors.
And that was the entrance, you know, to this squat.
Did it have the slide and the big cushion at the bottom of it and all that?
The first night we had Steve Beresford, who couldn't play because somebody had broken all the hammers off the piano. Lesson to self. Next time, check the piano when you get a venue. Evan, I think Lytton was there maybe. John Collins, a trombone player. Peter Kuzak, me, Dave Solomon. There was a team of about 12 people to go to this gig, you know, and it was in Time Out and stuff. You know. And that was the first gig I organised. And then after that, I'd always be sort of organising gigs. And then when the theatre club went, and before the Musicians Co-op, I think before the co-op finished, but before the LMC started, I think, I started doing things at the Artists' Meeting Place in Covent Garden, which that ran on a weekly basis for quite a long time.
Sure,
so I've been organising gigs since 1973. Because there's, you know, if you don't do it, nobody else is going to. You've got to put stuff on, as you know.
I mean, it sounds like the Spurs that grew out of the, if it's correct to say that, the little theatre club, that it sort of, it organised a scene, you know, for good or worse, whether which one you belong to, but people found what they wanted to do and they went off and did it.
I think, you know. So. I mean, for Dave and I, and Dave's not interested now, he's playing straight ahead jazz. I mean, he's not interested, but, you know, he's not doesn't want to play this music anymore. And he feels a bit kind of fraudulent around it, I think, sometimes, which is stupid, but then he likes guilt. Sometimes, bless him, he's such a lovely bloke. And a good drummer, I think. But anyway, for us at that time, the axis of the music revolved around the Little Theatre Club and the Musicians Co-op.
Yeah.
And that was the interesting stuff, and Incas Records.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that
was... Were you ever part of the kind of overtly ideological, political kind of approaches? Because I suppose the Little Theatre Club, I mean, I'm sure it had many different kind of approaches, many different, you know, people who saw something of their own ideas in the way it operated. But I suppose Eddie Prevost would be one line. Then you would have Maggie Nichols and the kind of feminist improvisation strain and so on, where the organisation of this music was seen almost imagistically as a...
Yeah, I mean, I tend to describe myself now as a utopian anarchist. I just wish people could get on and without any bloody interference and just sort of be nice to each other and put the tools down, you know, weapons of mass destruction or whatever, and just... And I realise that's a utopian thing, but that's a kind of goal to aim for, that people should just get on with each other, really, and we should live in a universe that runs on the principle of kindness, you know, things like that. But at the time, I did, thanks to Maggie's influence, I ended up kind of doing rehearsals with the WRP actors section, with Vanessa Redgrave and Tom Kempinski and Malcolm Cheney and Pete Armitage and Keke Markham and all of these people. And there was one bit, and the idea was to do this show of the Russian Revolution at Alexandra Palace in front of 4,500 trade unionists. And Vanessa Redgrave had written a song for it. Little people, right? Oh no, wait a minute, hers was... what good is the land? What good is freedom when I'm dead and my sons are dying? When there's no bread, I'll fight for the right time. You know, this sort of stuff. And Pete Armitage had to sing a song. Well, I'll tell you about that in a minute. Anyway, so what the idea was, they were going to have written music and improvised music.
Yeah.
So we'd have these rehearsals in various warehouses and sheds in London, sort of thing, that actors use. And I remember one bit where I got the electric guitar and I was playing it with a file, making this kind of real grim sort of sound, because the actors were queuing up in a bread queue.
Yeah.
And Pete Armitage, one of the actors, turned to me and said, can you stop that? It's getting on my nerves. And I thought, well, you are in a break, mate. What do you expect? Anyway, it came to the day of the... got close to the day of the show, and the woman who was going to conduct the written parts couldn't do it because she had an emergency call deadline to do some arrangements for the Harry Seacombe show. That's what she was doing for the telly. So I ended up dressed as a Russian general conducting an 11-piece orchestra in front of 4,500 trades unionists at Ali Pali. And one of the things I had to do, there was a terrible echo there, and I had to lip read Pete Armitage as General Kornilov singing a song which went, little people rise and follow me, here I am your man of destiny, rom pom 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 tiddly iddly pom, General Kornilov your saviour, umching 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 umching, like this. I had to lip read it. And I managed to just get through that, and I was kind of like, oh, it's horrid, you know. And then it came to the end for the Internationale, and I conducted it so slow, I counted it in, it was like a bloody funeral march. And people didn't sing or anything, it was just 4,500 people, like, mouths agog, like, what's this, you know. Yeah. And once somebody got up from the band, the house band, as it were, And conducted it. Yeah. I completely lost it. Oh dear. And then just after that I heard that Mal Dean had died. And Mal was a trumpet player, worked with did cartoons for Melody Maker. And he'd asked me to play in the Amazing Band, the last version of the Amazing Band, before he died at Ronnie Scott's, actually. Yeah. When I was 17, I think. At that, quite soon after, a few months after I'd been around, you know, come to London. And he'd got cancer and he died at 33, and it was pretty horrible. And I just heard about Mal dying, and there was a party afterwards, you know, a couple of days afterwards at Vanessa Redgrave's house. And I spent the whole party crying, actually, and just finding all this kind of stuff too much.
Yeah.
And then they did the show somewhere else, Westminster Hall, and I wasn't asked to do it. Mm-hmm. But basically, the kind of feminist thing, I felt there was a couple of things. Maggie explained it very well, because Maggie's great, you know, and always been a lot of time for Maggie. I play in a trio with Maggie and Mia Zabelka, Trio Blurb. Yeah. And I've got a lot of respect for Maggie. She's a great, warm-hearted human being. But there was one point where... at the Musicians Collective, they had women's only nights.
Yeah.
And they got a grant from Camden, and the audience had to be women only, you know. And Maggie explained to me that some women are so damaged that they need separatist kind of places to, you know, feel comfortable.
Sure.
And that's fair enough, actually. But it did feel kind of strange, the separatism, at that time on the feminist thing, I have to say. And, you know, I mean, I don't know anything about the other sex. Still, I'm 60. It's a mystery.
But you say that was like when you were 17.
No, this was a bit later on. Yeah.
So, you were still young, though.
Yes. We're talking about. Yeah.
I mean,
it's kind of
anyone's money, you know.
It's kind of. It's kind of. It can be a bit intimidating, of course, all of that. So.
But the music that you were was available to you to kind of become a part of, to move to London, to kind of, was an incredible mix.
It was.
Improvisation seemed to be to find a place in that, scene.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much it was kind of looking for a place in it. I don't know. I mean, I think people were... First of all, there was a kind of anti-jazz thing, if you like, mostly from the players that used to play jazz or approximate playing jazz, I think. But I kind of worked it out, and I've since talked with Henry Lowther about this because he's a great jazz musician. And I think what happened then was that some of those guys needed to be a bit anti in order to create a polemic, to make a space for themselves,
sure.
You know, to kick a few people out of the way so that they could plant their flag, basically. And certainly Jamie Muir has said to me that he regarded it, at that time, regarded it as an anti-music. You know, it was a statement of against. I didn't see that. You see, I mean, for me, it was a music of inclusion, and it wasn't against. Although I kind of, we used to talk about the music a lot. You know, it's the music. And I'm a big fan of that, and I still am in a way. I still get this kind of thing of people selling out somehow, you know, like you see people. It was like the John Cage centenary. Excuse me, I'm getting rather discursive on this, but the John Cage centenary, there were a lot of people who got gigs out of it. Now, Cage said he didn't like improvised music. And so there's these improvisers getting it. And all of that, and making a big brouhaha. Now, I remember 20, 30 years ago that somebody once said to me, well, he's a good inventor, but not a good composer. Nobody talked about the composition. Cage became this hero, this deified hero.
Yeah.
I personally think that the best thing that John Cage did was to talk about the portable aesthetic and opening your ears. I mean, remarkable. I'm fantastic. And last year I was talking to his mate, Takehisa Kasugi in Japan. And he told me that on the day that John died, he'd left instructions that things should go on as normal. And Merce Cunningham, his life partner, went to the dance studio and just took dance classes as normal. Now that is fantastic. I find that so touching and so real in comparison to the, oh, I've got a gig, man. You know, I'm doing some Cage. I find that so horrible and so against the spirit of the man, you know. And so I find that sometimes when I see improvisers sort of, oh, I'm doing this gig, I'm doing that gig, and, you know, and they're trying to make a living, for heaven's sake. Yeah. There's nothing, you know, it's fine. But just for me, I think, I want authenticity. You know, I'm always searching for authenticity about something in a way.
Yeah.
You know, that Walter Benjamin, the work of art in the age of mechanical reproduction, he talks about what is authentic now.
Yeah.
You know, and I still want that authenticity. And for me, improvising authenticity comes from the here and now, the live performance.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And there's a kind of thing where it's about playing.
Yeah.
And it's about listening in the present. And it doesn't go from there. That's what it's about. Now, people will use different lenses because it is about strategy. You know, we use bigger parts of our brain when we're improvising, and we make a kind of strategy. And there is a very good argument, I think, to say that music exists in our heads. It's not a question of the sound. It's how we structure it. So with this open ear, portable aesthetic of Cage, or deep listening of Pauline Oliveris, or whatever, Or John Stevens, listening, you know, listening is fantastic. That is such an important lesson.
Yes.
With that listening and with playing, which you have to do, which is you and the dialogue with your instrument or the dialogue with your voice or whatever, that's what it is. We might use, sometimes it all comes together, or occasionally we'll use different lenses, which we keep swapping around, you know. But there's a terrible attraction to start thinking, oh, I've got this lens now. So I'm going to take that bit from the improvisation, and I'm going to develop that as a thing, and make a genre from it, you know, and that sort of stuff, which happened with the reductivist lowercase music and so on and so forth. It's not to say that there's not some good music there. It's just, for me, I want to feel that you bring everything to the situation of that time. You don't have to use it. It's not showing off and look what I can do, and, you know, flying over 23 barrels on roller skates while going through fiery hoops and playing the Wizzo cadenza from hell or something like Paganini. It's just about having that generosity of spirit about you, everything that you can offer, you know, is important into playing and listening in the present.
Problem in that, though, in terms of, say, you know, you've been involved in this music and involved in that process and that aspiration, as it were, for a good number of years now. You know, to some extent, you develop a repertoire of your own that is always present and always quite kind of recognisable. We are,
well, yeah. You
know, so is the authentic available?
Of course, but you can't. You know, people talk about thinking outside the box. Well, to a certain extent, you can never get outside the box. You can't live in a universe of dark matter, if you like, because we can't see it. You know, we can't perceive it. It's outside of our thing, and there's stuff outside of us that we can't begin to imagine.
Yeah.
But what we do is, I think there's two main ways in which we develop our material. And it's, one is the rural and one is the urban. And the rural way of developing material is like a farmer gets a piece of land and he puts water on it first thing. Next year, some fertilizer and so on. He's growing from a central point and it's growing outward. You know, and it's that central point. And maybe the outside of how it grows is the material you're using at that time. But there is this core that's always present and you grow from a center. So anyway, there's that growing from a center, which I associate with a rural thing. And then there's the urban thing, which is you get up in the morning, you're one sort of person, you're on the tube, there's another sort of person, you're in the office, you're another sort of person, you go to the pub, you're another sort of person, and it's much more compartmentalized and linear. And I think with improvisation, you're constantly bringing those two things together. So you have a linear development and a from the center development. And you can hear people, it's very, you know, you can hear people's, if it's not to do with stylistic genre swaps or something like that, you can hear elements of the same player in a younger player that you hear in an older player. You know, and that will be there because that's their core development somehow.
Yeah.
And one of the things I do when I put kwakwa groups together, which I like to do, is I like to think in terms of the orchestration. Now, the orchestration means the instrument plays, so I'll have percussion, bass things, higher things, string things, blowing things, brass things, reed things, electronic things, like that. But the other part of the orchestration is musicality. And every improvising musician has their own musicality because they come from a wealth of different experiences. So it's thinking about that musicality and putting that together to put these groups to create some kind of fertile ground. And what I like to do, which seems to work with kwakwa, is to have groups where there's existing strands and skeins running through it, so there's some degree of familiarity and some juxtaposition with new stuff. So it's not a company thing, it's kind of more subtle than that. It's not putting people against each other so they'll fight and stuff to bring stuff out. It's not to do that at all. And so that's how I think of the kwakwa group. So to me, the orchestration, it's not just the instrument, but the musicality of the player. And incidentally, Radu Malfatti told me that this is why he thought that the Ellington band didn't last as long after Ellington died as the Count Basie band, because Count Basie was using arrangements outside. Ellington was writing specifically for the people in the band. And I think that's quite an interesting point to be had. So the individual has their own musicality.
And that's acceptable within the search for the authentic.
It's very acceptable.
Or is it unavoidable? I mean,
well, it's unavoidable. It's unavoidable, and it's the kind of thing. For me, I don't want to go against the human condition. It's a celebration of being human. That's where it gets political. It's a celebration of humanity and generosity and kindness. I think, if it's a human failing, well, let's celebrate it because it's human. In that sense. But I think there's four ways of playing, actually. The solo, which is completely different because it's about you and the dialogue with the instrument and the audio and the environment that you're in, the audience, whatever. Then there's one-off playing things where it's, you know, you're thinking on your feet immediately, straight out of the box, wallop. Then the stuff that comes together for a project, limited time period thing. And then there's long-term stuff. And I think that all those four aspects have something beneficial to help the improviser, you know, for what they do. And I think that the difficulty is, I mean, I Gianni Mimmo, Italian saxophone player, said I've got a multiplexity of approach. It is a multiplex, John. And it's kind of true, but then that's how the universe works. You know, it's not a two-dimensional universe. It's a multiplexual kind of thing. So all the kind of aspects are in there and juggled around, and sometimes it's not clear to people, you know, who want to buy into the idea of a style in a sort of consumerist sense. You know, I don't want a label that stands out and it has to be that, and you have to wear those sort of clothes to listen to it.
Yeah.
And all of those kind of things, you know. That kind of makes it difficult for people. Also, I was thinking that what can make it difficult for people is they go, if they've not come across it before, then everybody sounds the same. You know, so people will say, oh, he sounds like him or so and so. But, you know, once you listen a bit, you know that's not true.
Mm.
You know, so a lot of people said I sound like Derek Bailey. Early on, I got a lot of stuff from Derek, which was very useful material, but I developed it my own way. In fact, I spent 3 years having nothing to do with him so I could spend the time. Yeah. And then after 3 years, I went back to listen to him playing, and he was using some of the things I developed independently.
Yeah.
And that's just because we're working on the same
instrument,
you know. So that's like kind of people who will say, oh, Ritchie Blackmore sounds like Jeff Beck, or, you know, or Jimmy Page, or Tel Farlo sounds like Barney Kessel, or, you know, Elvin Jones sounds like Buddy Rich, or something like this, you know.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you're playing an acoustic guitar, and you're using thick plectrums and thick strings, and you're using harmonics and stop. You're playing the instrument. You're playing
a lot of shared elements.
You're playing the whole instrument. Yeah. It's going to sound in the same area.
Yeah.
You know, you can't help that.
Yeah.
But if you just crack on with it, you end up sounding like yourself. You know, and I made a decision early on not to rule out anything.
Yeah,
I thought that was important, so I wasn't going to think in that reductivist way and say, oh, I'm only going to do this because then I'm creating my own music, you know. And I made a decision to play acoustic guitar because I'd read something about, I forget whether it was Chick Corea or Herbie Hancock had said at the time of the Fender Rhodes piano, play acoustic piano, you develop your own voice. If you play a lot of Rhodes, you just end up sounding the same, you know. And I thought, yeah, if I get an acoustic guitar, my voice will come out, you know, a lot more. And over time, it did, you know. And the other thing I didn't want to do was to play electric guitar and get a new pedal, you know. That's it. I've got a new pedal. Yeah. Great. What an innovation, you know. What's new about that? And the only... And so I was looking for that authenticity there, you know. So that was my way of looking for authenticity. I mean... Everybody makes their own authenticity, actually, and probably makes their own stories, which aren't necessarily true either.
Well, you talked about having a sort of a core development, you know.
Yeah.
Do you, as an improviser, do you ever find that in your own playing, you reflect on your playing and think, this is a crisis, I'm not doing this and there's a core that you can retreat to?
I think there's times when there's plateaus, actually, where you reach a plateau. I think everybody finds plateaus in their playing. And you can either play through it or you can not play for a couple of weeks and then pick it up, a bit like doing the crossword. You know, if you put the crossword down, you're stuck. And it's still in that Jamesian way, bubbling away in the deep well of the unconscious, you know. So there are various ways of dealing with plateaus and sometimes to play through it. In fact... I went to when I was early 20s, very young, and I saw Derek play and I thought he was a bit stuck. And I invited him to Kent for a week and we stayed in my old bedroom at my grand's house and he used one of the outbuildings there to practice guitar for a week.
Yeah.
He jumped at the chance for that.
Do you have a sort of a core sense of what you play though as an improviser that you can kind of re-examine or...
Yeah,
acts as a place of solace in those plateau moments, you know.
Yeah,
it will free me.
There's all sorts of things. I mean, there's a couple of chords I use which have 6 of the 12 notes in, and I call them glue chords. Because if you're lost in an improvisation, you can bung those in and you've got a 50-50 chance of one of the notes being right. You know? That sort of thing, you know. Yeah. I mean, that there's kind of sort of practical...
things that help, and then there's the thing that if you think you played something wrong, do it again. It doesn't sound like a mistake. And there's various kind of, yeah. But I try and stop myself. If I catch myself doing that, I think, yeah. No, you know, stop it.
Yeah.
You know, you try and stop yourself doing those yeah. things. It's yeah. nonsense, you know. I was talking years ago to Jean-Michel van Schalberg, and he told me they had a group in Brussels that kept changing instruments because they wouldn't play the same instrument, so they wouldn't play cliches. Well, it's complete nonsense, because you pick up an instrument for the first time, it's just going to sound the same, you know. That's where it sounds the same. Yeah. Samuel Beckett talks about there's spirituality comes from depth, but I think there is a kind of depth about stuff that comes, you know. I mean, I sort of work it out. I do actually, apart from improvising workshops, I also give work. I also teach free improvisation guitar techniques, and I'm also booked in to give a workshop on that in Hanover. We're still talking about dates this year, and I'm not averse to doing that, you know. So what I say with that, I mean, I take George Van Epps's view of fingerboard harmony, which is to do with string sets, so you can have string one and two, string one and three, string one and four, string two and three, you know, and all
yeah,
of that,
yeah.
String one, two and three, string one, three, all the combinations of strings, then the harmonics, the stop notes, various exercises. There's a very nice Roger Smith exercise, which I tell people and show people, and I tell them that it's Roger Smith, you know.
Yeah.
I learned this from Roger Smith. And so there are certain kind of favourites, but then again, this came from Derek Bailey, that, you know, you can watch football players spend a lot of time running on the spot, but when it comes to the match, you don't see them doing it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of true about practicing. You can do scales and stuff, but you don't play scales when you're improvising.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
It's all a balance, and that's where the humanity comes into
yeah.
it. It's finding a sort of trying to find some sort of reasonableness.